Hello and welcome to our Unusual Dialogues. Today I'm hosting an interview with David from Red Facilities in Edinburgh. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you doing? Good to
Hi.
See you.
Hi, I'm very proud and grateful to be here. Honestly, this is, guys, for the first time a podcast from an actual recording studio, so you might hear the difference.
I'm interested that you're proud, but that's a real honor for me to hear that you're proud to be here. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it might not be my studio just yet, but
we can not
talk
yet.
About that later.
Exactly.
Thank you for being here. So first and foremost, before we jump into it, could you just briefly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, of course. My name's David Johnson, and I'm one of the directors here at Red Facilities. What we are is... We're basically, the posh name for it is an audio post-production company, which is a posh name for a recording studio, which is kind of how I got my start in this business. But the kind of work we do now isn't with musicians really at all. We do very little music. Mostly it's for commercials, for film, for corporate companies as well. We do audio for all that kind of thing. And with the pandemic, we've moved into some new areas in video as well. So it's been an interesting time for us. We're a technology-based business, obviously, so things are changing all the time. So welcome, and thank you for coming in to see us.
That's amazing. That's really interesting. And straight away, I will ask then, how did it come about that you're running a recording studio?
Well, there is a question. When we first met, I think I mentioned somewhat unwisely that I'd been playing in some bands when I was a teenager. As the age I'm at just now, I'm in my 50s. So for a young teenage guy back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, we were really bored and there was no internet, there was nothing to do. So forming a band was what you did. And so we formed a couple of bands, a heavy metal band, and then a kind of new romantic Duran Duran style band, trying to get the elusive record deal that was the holy grail at the time. And so I did all that. And while we were in these bands, as most kids in bands would do at that time, we had to go make a demo tape so we could send it off and, you know, to record companies and things like that. So we'd go into recording studios. And I think the moment I walked into a recording studio, once you could see through all the cigarette smoke and everything else that was going on, I thought, this is the place I want to be. I love this. I love all the technology, the mixing desk, the tape and everything. And just the whole process of you play something, you listen to it back, you try and make it a little bit better, you try and get things to mix together. I was really bitten with that bug. And, you know, as it turned out, you know, my bands weren't terribly good. But I still had the drive to get back into the recording studio somehow. And so some time ago, I opened up a studio to record bands, and I realized that really there wasn't enough work around to make that work, and kind of fell into making commercials for ad agencies who were happy to come into a smelly old recording studio and record some adverts for their clients. And do you know what? I enjoyed that as well. A lot of people in recording kind of look down their noses a little bit because it's not really art. What we do here, we're making commercials, we're doing commercial work. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. I was in the place I wanted to be, surrounded with equipment, good fun, great to hear the stuff that you finished on the radio or on the TV or on the internet. And so I kind of wanted to be a pop star, but I ended up second best, maybe. Or maybe actually, in hindsight, the best decision. But the other side of the glass doing the recording, you know?
That's amazing. That's yeah. I really like the cigarette smoke part, which sets the scene.
Something you don't see now. You don't see that. I mean, you know, when we were younger, people smoked everywhere, in the cinema, on the top of the bus, everything. Maybe in Poland, it's still a big thing, smoking.
Oh.
I don't know.
Not in the buildings anymore. But I know for a fact that there used to be smoking and non-smoking seats in the plane, and they were on one side and the other.
That's right. The little ashtray.
How absurd is that idea? Wow. Okay, so... You came about to create your own sound recording studio because you met some people that you were able to do it with, or was it your own initiative and you had the funds and the means to start it?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. The thing is that certainly back then, any recording equipment of a good standard was really expensive. So you actually had to be quite wealthy or know someone that was quite wealthy that was willing to invest their money into a recording studio. And at that time, you know, quite a few wealthy people would do that. They liked the idea of hanging out with musicians and things. That wasn't the route I was able to go down. So I and a friend, we went to a thing called the Prince's Trust, which is like a charity here in the UK that is sort of overseen by Prince Charles. And we said, look, we've got this idea. We want to open up a recording studio. We found a place in a kind of rundown part of town. Can we get some money to help out? And they went, yeah, there you go. There's a few thousand pounds. It wasn't a big amount of money at all. And it was a loan. It had to be paid back. But we knew that the existing recording studios weren't going to give us a job because there's just not enough work. So if we were going to do it, we had to do it ourselves. And so we borrowed a little bit of money. We found an old industrial unit and we got some bricklayers in. We just didn't have a clue what we were doing. Built some walls, got some glass, built some, you know, finishes for these brick walls and stuff. We had no ventilation. It was, you know, horrible fluorescent lights, and just got going. And we must have recorded every heavy metal band in Scotland at that time because we were cheap. We didn't really know what we were doing. We made loads of mistakes, but that's a very good way to learn. So I think the expression self-starting comes to mind. We had to kind of, if we wanted to do this, we just had to get on and do it ourselves because, you know, there was no one else that was going to give us a job like that, you know.
Wow. And was that here in Edinburgh?
That was here in Edinburgh, yeah. Yeah, a part of town called Granton. And, you know, it was tough. I think I remember when we were building our original studio, you know, we put all the equipment in, but we didn't have any insurance, so we'd have to sleep in the building, you know, with like a hammer just in case anybody broke in. It was a pretty rough part of town at the time. And so we would do stuff like that. We would take on second or third jobs to give us enough money just to keep going because it was really hard. And you know, we had a bank loan, and I remember the bank manager calling us in and saying, how are you guys eating? You know, and we're going, well, we're doing our best, you know. But I think at the end of the day, that's what we wanted to do. I wasn't really qualified to do anything else. And so I supplemented my income by working in nightclubs and bars, washing dishes, all that kind of thing. It was very glamorous.
It definitely sounds close to being a rock star.
Oh, it was, yeah, it was very much a wake-up call. You know, it's a lot of hard work, but as I say, there was nowhere really else we could learn how to do this, or I could learn how to do it. You know, if I wanted to, say, work with the BBC, I would have needed to go to university or something like that. So I didn't have any of that education. I left school at 16 with, like, a couple of O grades, you know, a couple of very low passes and something. So, I, you know, the pressure was on for me to try and make something happen, you know.
Wow. Let me just quickly jump into that. Did you end up leaving school because of your band?
Well, yeah, probably. Rock and roll had a lot to do with it. You know, I was a very nice, quiet little boy, you know, a nice middle-class little boy from Edinburgh. And then I discovered Motorhead, you know. So it was kind of all downhill after that. So, but do you know what? Again, I don't want to sound like a really old guy here, but at the end of the day, there wasn't the other distractions about it. If you really wanted to go for something, a lot of people would just go for it. I mean, I see now, certainly with my own kids who are teenagers, that they really worry about the future a lot. Whereas back then, we would just have a go, you know, and that's what we would try and do.
That's amazing. And, you know, with Motorhead, fair enough. Coming back to sleeping on the floor, I've read in Slash's autobiography that the Guns N' Roses, for the very first time of their career,
that's right,
slept in their garage as well, and they had the best time of their life with this Night Train drink, apparently.
Yes, that's right.
The cheap wine.
That's right.
So, to some extent, I can see that you've been just living the life, sort of, you know, maybe from behind the glass, so to speak, but definitely experiencing the same amount of drama and experiences.
Well,
there.
Well, I would say in the early days, you know, certainly for people who come into the studio now, they don't see anybody who might have been in Guns N' Roses. But, you know, when I was 17, 18, there is a kind of gang mentality of it's us against the world. And that's quite cool. And life certainly didn't seem so complicated back then. You know, you had a very quick reaction to any effort you put into something. You saw a quick return for that effort. And as I say, for me, it was a really good learning experience in all ways: how to run a business, how not to overspend, how to budget, how to pay your bills. It was a really, really good experience. And I think as that business eventually finished, and then I started another business, and then this business here that we're speaking from today, you learn a lot on the way. And I think that's the thing. Sometimes things take time, and you need to have, you know, you need to have a few failures behind you, you know, but learn from those failures. That's the thing. You don't want to keep making the same mistakes again. You've got to have a few in your back pocket to help you mature as a person as well, you know.
Definitely. As I mentioned earlier, you know, my father on the podcast mentioned that his biggest intake is to have patience and,
yeah,
you know, whatever you're doing, just keep doing. But I was going to ask, and you sort of answered the question already. You said there was another business and then Red Facilities,
yeah,
came around.
That's right.
Has it always been the same people being involved?
No.
If not, what was the case?
Yeah, no, the very first kind of rock and roll studio was me and another guy, and you know, we were friends, and actually we sort of fell out of being friends, I suppose, although you know, we haven't seen each other since then, but I certainly have no bad wishes towards him at all. We were just really young, you know, and
17, 18, 19,
you know, over that period of time, you know, and he wanted to get on with his life, and you know, I respect that, and I was maybe too stubborn. I was like, I'll make this work, you know, and all the rest of it. So that relationship came to an end. At the end of that, I met my current business partner, Max, and he'd been doing a lot of band recording and programming for musicians and things like that. And we set up a jingle company. Now, if you don't know what jingles are, they're the sung adverts, and they were very in fashion back then. And we would write music for well-known companies, if you like. And that kind of took off. We knew that the building we were in with that old studio had to go. So I was mentioning that it was made of bricks. So we literally had to get sledgehammers and break it down and put every brick into a skip. So,
why?
So that's because we had to return the building back to what it was.
As it was. Oh,
so it's
God.
Like, again, another big learning experience about when you don't own the building you're in. So we did all that, and it was just brutal. You know, we kept having walls falling on us and things. And I think the funniest thing was being able to remove all the bricks around a grand piano. We had a piano, and that managed to miraculously not get destroyed, you know.
Wow.
So we moved from there to a proper recording studio, which was called REL, which was up in the Sheens part of Edinburgh, Newington. And it had had some hit singles over the years. So it was like a real proper big recording studio. And we walked in and went, this is where we want to be. And we knew they had a spare room, but they didn't want us there at all because we just looked like trouble, which we probably were. And eventually, through a kind of trading of skills, in other words, we said to them, well, if you let us use that spare room you've got, we'll do stuff for you for free. We managed to get to an arrangement where we started doing things. And that's where our sort of commercial company making ads and things all started taking off.
And you were separate.
So we were separate from their main company. So it was just me and Max, and we just worked away. And then we eventually, after some years there, realized we needed our own place. And that's when we found this place here in Leith and started working from here. So when you come up to our door, you'll see two names on the door. There's Howarth and Johnston, which was our jingle company. And it sounded like a firm of lawyers, you know. And then, so we could separate the studio as a standalone thing, we call the studio Red Facilities. So if you're booking in just to do your own stuff, you just book in through the studio. If you want us to write you a jingle, God help you, then we will be Howarth and Johnston for that. So it was quite a good way to separate the two businesses, because what we found was people would come to us and say, oh, could you write us some music? Oh, and can we just have some studio time thrown in as well? So we just thought, nah, let's separate it. We can charge separately. And that's worked really well.
So do you still create jingles?
No. They've become so awfully out of fashion that nobody dares ask for a jingle now. But some of the ones we've done over the years still crop up. We still have people phoning up asking if they can use them and relicense them and things like that. And that's something else we discovered, again, that we had no knowledge of, is proper control over your music, getting it registered, making sure you get your royalties on it. All these things we're completely unaware of. But you find out quickly, and you need these sort of little revenue streams running around your main business just to keep yourself going. When one side goes quiet, the other side can support the side that has gone quiet. So if you have all sorts of skills, that's a good way, as I'm sure you're discovering as well with your writing and podcasting and filmmaking. The days of just being one thing are long gone. You know, if you have talents, you'll probably find that they will go into other things as well.
Definitely. I think, you know, statistically, I don't know if it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was estimated that people nowadays are going to change industries or jobs seven times on average.
Yeah.
And this is obviously starting up as a bar staff, whatever, and then going on to do other stuff. But that suggests that you need to have at least those, let's say, three or four different areas of interest that you're working on. Definitely.
I think that's really important. And do you know what? There's not a job that I've done that hasn't been useful later on. So if you work in a hospitality job, being a waiter or something like that, it just means when you're welcoming people into your recording studio, you remember how people like to be treated. And you make sure they've got something to drink and something to eat and they're being looked after. And, you know, that goes a long way. You know, our experience of coming into the sort of professional audiovisual side of things is everybody was quite grumpy, you know, because everybody's worried looking over their shoulders that you weren't there to take their job or something, or you were questioning their professionalism or something like that. And I think at the end of the day, we're happy doing what we're doing. We try and create a nice atmosphere here and be friendly. And so, again, all those things that you learn when you're either waiting tables or washing dishes, they all come in useful later. I mean, God knows how many coffee cups I've washed here in my time. You know, it's all handy.
Definitely. And that's as well very reassuring, you know, from, from a standpoint of where I'm at the moment. What my father said to me recently was that he's really happy that I'm working in a wine-based business, because knowledge about alcohol and about wine is something that very often in a like larger scheme of things becomes a part of your introduction to someone,
or absolutely
a business meeting, choosing the right wine, or even knowing about the wine type, which I'm still yet to discover. But it definitely is one of those things that, as you said, it we never know when it's going to come in handy.
You never know. And, you know, that's been my experience. And I would say, as a as an older person to you, as a younger person, is that a bit like what we're doing today, you know, I hadn't met you till maybe 2 weeks ago. And here we are doing this. And at the end of the day, you are somebody who I wish the very best for. And I might be able to recommend you to somebody now that I know the kind of person that you are. So I think it's all very well being a kind of undiscovered secret, but you have to these days, you know, let people know where you are. And you talk about, you know, breaking conversation with someone. You notice somebody's ordering wine or something like that. If you've got a little bit of knowledge, you don't want to appear like a know-it-all.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's a great way in, and it's much nicer than talking about the weather, you know.
Definitely. And yeah, I agree. This is very, you know, if anything, in our day and age, networking is probably the next biggest thing, because as you said as well, back in, I don't know exactly, but I can imagine that back in the 70s, it was much more difficult to be present everywhere, which meant that it was more impactful to just meet one, two, three people and just show up. Whereas nowadays, especially with this world going more and more digital, you're showing up where everyone else is showing up. There is millions of podcasts, there is millions of posts at every second being posted, and this becomes a different type of, I don't know, food to eat, you know. You're no longer focused on one person, sort of an apprenticeship with a master, Rather, you're putting yourself out there with all of those possibilities.
That's right.
But with all of those avenues all meeting in the same place, and it's just a one big scream, I would say.
But, you know, it's funny just picking you up on that because, you know, growing up, you're right, it was really hard to get to people to speak to them. You would probably join a golf club or something, you know, hideous like that. Sorry if you like golf. but, you know, my dad was a golfer and he would meet people on the golf course. So if you didn't join the golf course or have the money to join the golf course, you know, you're cutting yourself off. Now, as you say, we've almost got a level playing field here. But there's so many people that to kind of get your head up above everybody else is actually quite hard. So it's still a little bit tough, even though you've got more avenues. But I do agree. I think at the end of the day, what you're doing is putting you way ahead of everybody else who says, oh, I'd love to have a podcast, or I'd like to be a writer, or I'd like to do this. You're actually doing it. And it's in my experience that once you start doing things, things happen. You know, when you sit and go, one day I'll write that book, or, you know, go write it. You know, what are you waiting for? I mean, this is the thing, that there is a finite amount of time to do these things, and you're better just to get on. And in my experience, you're better just to get on and fail than not do it at all. And failure is a really funny word. Is it really? I mean, you can tell me, you know, is it really failing or is it learning? I don't know.
I guess it's only, it can be learning as long as you really learn something from it.
Good point.
I guess that's the trap. And then in that regard, maybe failure is a thing as well. If you've not managed to learn, then you probably have to fail again at the same thing. Or in a similar frame, just so life can give you another slap and maybe wake you up this time. But that's all, you know, that's such a big topic. And I think, yeah, definitely with, you know, what you said, with doing stuff, that's maybe the aim of the podcast itself. I'm trying to maybe every now and then shake up people's day and inspire them to do something differently. What I wanted to ask before, though, and I'd like to come back to it because I feel like this is the closest I can get apart from reading Slash's biography.
Oh, here we go.
To the world of 70s art. How have you had, can you tell me like one or two craziest stories from recording studio with those, you know, as I assume bands, quite rough kind of vibe?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of bands would come from the kind of middle of central Scotland, which was like West Lothian. And, you know, these were tough guys, and they were all guys, apart from the obligatory girlfriends that would be, you know, listening to Fleetwood Mac or something. You know, it would be, that was the setup. These guys would come in, and, you know, I liked all the heavy rock stuff as well. So it was no surprise to me, you know, what came in. And at that point, in the 80s, it was just the time of Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, Wasp, which was kind of just after the stuff I'd been listening to. But this was big, you know. So you had guys that worked on the building site during the day and then came in, you know, with back-combed hair, spandex trousers, you know, the full nine yards. And there were a few funny things. I remember there was one thing where the drummer in one of the bands was going at it so hard and hitting these drums so hard, the actual steam was rising off his head. I mean, everybody in the band was saying, look, it started. And I'm going, what started? They said, look at the top of his head. And there was actual steam coming up off the top of his head. It was absolutely, you know, hilarious. The funny thing about working in the studio is that because you're kind of on an hourly rate, there wasn't much mucking about. So they kind of came in and tried to record as quickly as possible, to record as many songs as possible. And so it wasn't quite like you would imagine maybe Guns N' Roses or Motley Crue that have this kind of unlimited budget to record, you know. It was all pretty focused. But yeah, they would arrive with just the most enormous Marshall stacks and amplifiers and things. And
try to squeeze in.
Just squeezing in and, you know, usually the lead singer would be the one that would, you know, be getting the brunt of the practical jokes, you know, all this kind of thing, you know, having body parts placed on him while he was sleeping and things like that. I mean, it was just, it was a kind of free-for-all, but completely expected because they were all learning from the rule book, which was what they would read in the music magazines and stuff. So it'd be a lot of drinking, a lot of strange substances going on, and just that whole thing, as you can imagine. But yeah, you know, while in the studio, they were the rock stars, and then Monday morning, they'd be back, you know, working in the supermarket or something. It was very, very funny. But do you know what? It's something that's kind of gone now. There was a real kind of camaraderie amongst musical styles. So if you were in a rock band, you had a certain style and a look and a smell. If you were New Romantic or a goth or into industrial music or something, or dance, everybody had their own kind of fashion and look and everything, and in a way it's a shame that that's moved on now, you know, because you could spot the various things.
Do you mean,
you know,
it's sort of melted into a
homogeneous kind of thing? Yes, you know,
following on what you just said, I just wanted to wonder, like, obviously you said that you were on an hourly rate and they wanted to do it as fast as they could. I can assume that there was a certain level of pressure put on you to make sure that happens, but at the same time, being on an hourly rate, for instance, working as a gym instructor or you know, coaching a person, I sort of noticed that you being paid by the hour is not necessarily against yourself, as long as you're doing your job. So I can imagine that as well. It was sort of a freeing experience being the person on the side, only being responsible to not do wrong whatever you're supposed to do right, whereas it was up to them to actually deliver that song, to not fuck about, so to speak, to not, you know, smoke another ciggy or get out there drunk.
Yes, and you know, you have to remember as well, there wasn't a lot of money kicking around. So you know, if you've said, right, I think we charge £10 an hour and so you know, they might say, look, we've got £100, that's all we've got, and you'd be like, fine, so that's 10 hours. And you'd go over a little bit, you know, because you're having fun, and sometimes the band was really good, and you'd be like, do you know what, you just need to spend a bit more time on this. So we, you know, just throw in that time. You know, I'm not completely mercenary when it came to these things, and we would spend, you know, a lot of time, extra time on things, but you know, we were learning, that was the thing. But the whole model of the hourly rate of recording, when you looked at what you could possibly charge per hour compared to how much you had to spend on equipment and a room and insurance and everything, it was never going to add up. And that's the big problem. And certainly for a period of time, a lot of recording studios went bust because the expectation was they would have tons and tons of really expensive equipment, but no one was going to pay, you know, hundreds of pounds per hour for all that equipment. So it kind of meant the amount of studios around got smaller and smaller. Also, like we're doing today, you know, the availability of equipment at a really cheap price is amazing now. You can get set up and go and do everything that we would have done with £100,000 worth of equipment for a couple of thousand pounds. And because you've no tape to pay for. You know, you've got unlimited digital storage, you can put stuff up in the cloud. It's a massive change. What is really interesting, though, is now that everything's cheaper and anybody can do anything, it's not necessarily the case that what people are creating is that much better. There's a lot of it, but the question is it that much better? But that's another conversation. So
definitely, and that's another big topic, because maybe yet again the availability becomes the matter of perspective.
Like, yes, exactly.
If there is to choose out of 10, it's easier to pinpoint which one's great. If you have to choose out of 3,000,
exactly, exactly, and you're terrified you miss something, you know,
by the time you're by the hundreds, you don't remember the first one. Wow. Yeah, I'm loving this conversation, of course, but I'm mindful of your time.
No, it's okay.
Because of it, I would like to ask you one sort of a wrap-up question, so to speak. As always, I mention in the interviews, is there anything in particular that you would like to leave our listeners and myself with from your experiences, which are so fast in it, so I bet quite
that's nice of you to
quite the funky ones as well. I'd love to hear them, but I think this is a
well, do you know, the funny thing is, because I've got children myself now, and of course I look back at my behavior and think what a terrible child I've been, and I'd be horrified if any of my children did what I did. But what I really don't want to do is glamorize the route that I took. Because, you know, I've said this to my daughter and my sons as well, you know, it's all kind of worked out okay, you know, but the route was pretty grueling along the way, because I didn't have really any, you know, extra education or anything, or degrees or anything. You know, everything was that little bit different. And, you know, certainly growing up, while I would see people I've been at school with going off and having holidays and getting married and buying houses, that wasn't happening for me. You know, I was literally just constantly working to survive, you know. But what I would say is it's given me a really interesting life, and it's given me a really rich life. I haven't been, say, working for a company that's kept me within a specific bubble of people. So therefore, I have no experience of people outside that bubble. It's been really, really good and enriching, if you like, to have had some money, then had no money. The downsides to that are that you can tend to place money above what you should be doing. You know, you think, well, at least I'm getting paid for it. After a while, that runs pretty thin. If you're not spiritually enriching yourself, creatively enriching yourself, and also finding an outlet for your creativity as well, that can be a pretty nasty place to be in, you know. And I've met people who I think are really successful, and they go, yeah, but I wish I was still playing the drums. I'd be going, really? They go, yeah, no, you know, what I do is a job. It's just a job, and that's all it is, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to retire, and I'm going to die. And, you know, I'm thinking, God, that sounds really bad. And as I say, I wouldn't recommend the way that I've done my life to anybody. But it's been interesting. The main thing is to keep your ears open. There's a great saying, which is take the cotton wool out of your ears and put it in your mouth, which maybe I should be doing just now. You know, just don't speak all the time. Listen, you know, and you'll learn things. You know, that's the most important thing. There's some great old phrases I like, which have really served me well, which is measure twice and cut once, you know. I think that's the most important thing. If you're going to do something, just double check it. Then do it, you know. And the other one that I really like is how you do things is how you do things. So if I unpack that a little bit, if I am very slipshod and careless in the way I, for instance, record something or clean this microphone or something, I do it in a really bad way. That's a very good indication of how I do everything. So how you do things is how you do things. Try and do everything you do as well as you can, because that has a kind of roll-on effect to the big things. And then hopefully that will reward you in the end. And finally, I would just say, if there's something you really want to do, just do it. Do you know what I mean? Within reason, you know. But really, if that's what you want to do, everything else is going to be like second place, you know. So just do it, you know.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, especially on point with this idea of working for the paycheck and then working to retire and then dying. That's
sorry.
No, it might sound morbid, but this is literally, you know, it's a part of life. And if anything, this is something to maybe take into mind earlier on, rather than, as you said, work till you're however old and then realize, oh, I should have played the drums. Definitely, at the end of the day, we can always do it on the side. So even if it's not something that puts the bread on the table,
exactly,
I bet that there is plenty of space to do it anyway. Well, David, it's been a pleasure. I'm really, your stories are amazing, and I'd like to come back to it at some point and get us talking about some more of the experiences, especially 70s and 80s. I feel like, you know, you have such a different experience of 70s and 80s than my father. Just because Poland, Scotland, you know, different abilities, different perspectives, so to speak.
Do you know, the first job to interrupt I had was in a Polish delicatessen here in Edinburgh called Victor Hugo.
No way.
And it was owned by the Zhipkowski family. And when I was 13, the son, Carol, and I would break up the boxes. And that was my introduction to the Polish community here in Edinburgh, which was it continues to be amazing. And that delicatessen continues to grow and grow and grow. So he's doing really well for himself. Maybe you should speak to Carol.
Yeah, definitely. Hear his story of how he ended up here. Wow. But yeah, thank you very much for coming. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And it's good to see you again.
And guys, remember to stay happy, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time.